you know, in an odd way. Probably being based in Des Moines, Iowa was also a good thing. That was not, I don't want to attribute some kind of cosmic brilliance to that or whatever, but I think we wanted to be based where there were not a lot of other mortgage companies, so that we could kind of bring in and grow our talent but not have it disappear all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of the companies in the mortgage space that were really growing rapidly in that 2005, 2004, 2008 time frame, whatever, were, you know, West Coast based and or New York based. I mean, you had the Wall Street firms get into the business as well. And so, you know, it's hard to get a culture going there where people are moving between companies all the time, rapid startups, you name it. And I think being based where we were based, I think, was helpful that way.
You guys didn't use mortgage brokers, am I right?
We had a wholesale channel.
Oh, you had a wholesale channel.
We did do mortgage broker business, yes.
And how did that work in terms of incentives and sort of figuring out the quality of what you were getting and so on?
Well, of course, the mortgage brokers had their own thing. Our sales force was, again, commission-based on that, but it's a matter of working with the, you know, we would try to underwrite our brokers, and of course, we're underwriting the loans as well. And we applied the same fair and responsible lending principles to our wholesale product as we did to our retail product. So if someone brought us a non-prime loan, we would run it through our process, and if we determined that it could be a prime loan, we would not only write the broker and tell them that, we would write the customer and tell them that. And that had a dampening effect on the some of the business that we received from mortgage brokers on non-prime, but that's what we did.
But in terms of credit quality, one of the classic ways to deal with that is to look at early payment defaults. And in a housing bubble, they tend to be minimal. So how could you look at the credit quality of stuff that was coming in, take it from both the broker channel and the internal commission-based channel? How can you deal with measuring the quality of what somebody's bringing you?
Well, we're looking at it a variety of ways in terms of how well they're processing the loan, what the mix of product that we're seeing might be, a variety of factors that we're looking at. And of course, again, the lion's share of the production that we were doing would be Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac eligible product.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at Fannie and Freddie, and many of them have come already approved on their underwriting systems, right? But then we're going back and re-verifying information. We're not just taking that for what it's worth. Because the loan's going to be closed in our name, we're going to be pulling the closing documents. We're going to go back and re-verify aspects of that loan ourselves. So, and if we find people that are not, you know, complying with kind of our quality process, then they would no longer be eligible to sell this product.
And that was after the loan had closed? In other words, how do
no.
you avoid delaying the speed with which?
No, typically all that's done before the loan's closed.
Okay. And you could do it without sacrificing a lot of time
sure.
to closing?
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to close a loan in a wholesale channel if we haven't done what we felt at that point in time was the appropriate amount of work to close the loan.
Mm-hmm.
Our name.
Did you consider that unusual in the marketplace at that time? That extra layer of verification?
I don't know. I can't speak for what other companies were doing. I would say all of them had. I would expect not all of them. I would expect many of them had a layer of work. How much work they did? How seriously they complied with their process or whatever, I can't speak to.
What kind of reputation did you get for doing that?
Well, we were never the largest in the wholesale channel. We were a decent-sized player just because we were decent-sized in all our channels, but wholesale was our smallest channel. Mm-hmm. Of the three big channels we had, wholesale was the smallest of our channels. And our mix we've been the largest retail originator, meaning where we're dealing directly with the customer, going back to, I think, 1991. Mm-hmm. We've been a large correspondent lender and a smaller wholesale lender through that whole period of time. So I think we're considered a steady source for vanilla type product.
That's nice. I'd be interested in your colleague on the speed dial, sort of the relationship of you and the business units to the risk management function. Sort of how it worked, interactions at different levels. Let me leave it there first, and then we can drill down a bit.
Well, I think the Wells Fargo, and let me back up, you know, through this entire period of time, Mike Lalpin was not the chief credit officer at Wells, but another guy retired, and he moved into that position a number of years ago. But in terms of, take the people out of it, in terms of the structure, at Wells Fargo, we expect our business leaders to be accountable for the business and all the risks in the business. We think the people closest to the business should be running the business. With that said, there's a layer of control, a layer of oversight at either the group level, and I come back to that, or the holding company level, or both, in terms of the key risks in the organization, whether that's interest rate risk, credit risk, compliance risk, legal risk. You know, you go through the and then the audit, internal audit function that is at the really the board slash holding company level. Mm-hmm. And then you've got, of course, and then you have key board committees that are overseeing the credit risk. There's a credit risk committee, the finance committee oversees really the interest rate risk. You've got the audit committee that really oversees the audit compliance area. So it, you know, kind of starts at the top and cascades down, but it's really kind of top down, but also bottom up, and so it's unacceptable, you know, at Wells in the business to say, well, I was relying on Mike Laughlin and corporate credit to keep me between the lines. Now, your job as a business line manager at our 80 businesses is to manage all of the risks in your business, and have total transparency working all the way up through the holding company to the board level of you know, what's going on, if they want to understand, you know, as you cascade what's going on from an interest rate or credit risk management standpoint.
So as a division, were you worried about things other than credit risk, like interest rate risk or liquidity risk or something?
Sure. Oh. No, I mean, when I say interest rate risk, in terms of the mortgage company, for instance, the mortgage company manages the hedging of our pipeline and our warehouse and our servicing portfolio. And again, that structure is probably somewhat unique in terms of some of the big mortgage companies. But we've, again, always felt that the mortgage company has the best data and insight and information and understanding of the risk in a pipeline, a warehouse, or a servicing portfolio. So we're accountable for managing that, and that is a, you know, that is the type of interest rate risk we tend to have. We also have a portfolio of loans, but most of the it's fairly small. Most of the portfolio, when we talk about some of the things that we retained, would be retained on behalf of the bank, where the bank would say, well, I'm looking for assets that look like this, or et cetera. So then they, to us, they're like a Fannie Mae. They're an investor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's what you're looking for. Here's, we'll structure this. We'll agree on with the credit area in terms of what parameters we want to originate to, and we'll originate to the Wells Fargo as an investor like we'll originate to a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or a FHA.
When you say small, how much are you talking about?
We would generally not retain more than about 10% in any year, which could be a big number given our originations, mm-hmm. but I mean some years it was much lower than that. I'm sure some years it was maybe above that, but typically, it was not a large percentage of what we originated that we would retain.
Would you guys deal in getting financial guarantees for mortgage pools when you'd go in a transaction like that, or credit default swaps or anything else to try to protect against credit risk?
For our own portfolio?
Yeah.
Generally not. Generally, we would, I mean, we would have, almost always, we would have mortgage insurance on loans over 80% LTV. And it, again, because the view was these were going into portfolio, but should we want to sell them at some point in time, we wanted to have that ability to have them being, you know, well understood generic kind of product that has a generic type of mortgage insurance, et cetera, that we could pool and bundle and sell.
Could you deal in your underwriting with things like silent seconds? We've heard people talk that, well, I bought an 80% LTV loan. You know, I mean, the MIs, clearly, we're talking a long time about the 80-20s and 80-10-10s. And somebody would tell us, well, I bought the 80% LTV loan, and you simply couldn't tell that the next week somebody was putting on a silent second. Did you guys deal with that kind of issue?
Well, you know, I'd have to replay the tapes. I mean, I think when you're saying silent seconds, generally those are seconds that people haven't recorded.
Yep.
Right? So, you know, that's hard to discern if it's not recorded any place and it's not in a title report or credit bureau or anything like that. So you're having a, but a lot of that has to do if you're looking at people's assets to close and those kind of things. But, you know, it's hard to tell whether someone's going to go out and get a home equity loan. And certainly we did home equity lending. Mm-hmm. But they were not silent.
Right. Those are the
loud
ones you could see. Right. Right. In the old-fashioned bank, you would have a credit committee. The person that wanted to have the bank make the loan would come to the committee, and the underwriter would come with a green eye shade, and they'd have an argument about, gee, you know, what's the risk versus return? And if the process were managed well, you could end up structuring that loan in a way that satisfied the underwriting concerns, and at the same time you could make the loan. Was there in your risk management system that kind of conversation, or was it all internalized to you that you were responsible for credit quality virtually alone in terms of?
Well, let me answer that first. Again, the lion's share of the production was to external parties who made the rules, right? Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac.
Oh, I see.
Right.
Yes,
they made the underwriting rules. Now, for our own portfolio, that would go all the way, those requirements would go all the way to the holding company corp credit, would give the ultimate sign-off. So we might recommend, we might approve, and we being the mortgage company, say, might recommend at the group level, where I had multiple businesses, I had a group credit officer that would then take a look at this and have that kind of debate.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, and then they would either delegate to the group some authority to make those decisions, depending on a magnitude decision, or they would go all the way to the holding company to make the type of, if we were going to be doing any kind of material portfolio commitment, the holding company was going to be aware of and sign off on the underwriting parameters and, frankly, the changes if over time to those parameters.
And would you have a credit officer reporting to you?
I did, yes.
And
as a group, now the mortgage company had one.
Mm-hmm.
And at the group level, where I had the mortgage company reporting me and some other businesses, I had one. Not all through that period of time, but, you know, in the later periods, 2000, maybe 6 or 7.
And did they also report to the chief credit and risk and credit officer, or?
They were a solid line to me, but they were, you know, linked in very closely. In fact, my credit officer, I always had them based in San Francisco, so they would be close to the holding company.
What was their value added to you?
Well, their value added is, I mean, we're dealing business units that could be based in multiple locations around the United States. So in terms of data and understanding and knowledge, as a credit professional, they can do that anywhere. Being in San Francisco, they're close to the holding company, so they can be involved in all the holding company, the meetings that, say, Mike Laughlin might have, be close to the holding company in terms of communication, in terms of what's going on from a credit standpoint.
So you were, because so much of your product was going into the secondary market one way or the other, Fannie, Freddie, Ginny, whatever, you were, and then the stuff that you booked, you would have that kind of conversation, but you were basically letting the secondary market institutions underwrite or set the underwriting standards, and then you would meet those standards.
We would meet them or be tighter than them. I mean, there was places, there was times where we had credit overlays that were tighter than what our investors would allow.
Tighter than what your investors wanted? Yeah.
Well, when I say wanted, I mean, if they said, you know, we'll take this band,
yeah,
we might be this band.
Good.
Hard to get that on tape. But
right.
a narrower band.
Yeah, good.
Where we would take something off, you know, where we might have a filter that would bring, you know, the FICO score up or something from that. Just to, because, again, we're wanting to make sure, we also, we want to make sure that we comply with the investor guidelines and also are products that make sense for customers. And if we were a little concerned about that or concerned about our ability to deliver or concerned of anything about our sales ability to consistently deliver, we would, you know, tighten down, narrow up, whatever.
You were a division of the bank.
Correct.
Was there ever any value added from your regulators to any decisions you made?
Oh, I would say yes. I mean, I have to go back and think through. I mean, they, you know, I certainly would say that the, my experience is that the OCC is a pretty diligent regulator, mm-hmm. and asks a lot of good questions and is involved a lot in the business and understanding, and so you know that that's there,
mm-hmm.
And how you're and my experience would be that when I understand how our regulators ask questions about appraisals and appraisal values and how you order appraisals and are you doing, you know, stated income or limited documents or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and a litany of questions over the period of time compared to what you're seeing going on in the marketplace. I don't think that level of regulation and vigor was existent, certainly for big swaths of the shadow banking system.
Oh, yeah. So, and let me go to the other side. So it was not, I wasn't quite sure whether you said, gee, it was useful or it merely wasn't burdensome when they were asking all these questions.
Well, I think it was, I think it was useful. I mean, it was probably not, you know, pleasant in terms of, it wasn't unpleasant, it's just not from the standpoint of, you know, it's another layer of, you know, regulation and dealing with another party to make a decision or to, you know, it's always looking over your shoulder. Mm-hmm. It'd be easier in life if that weren't the case, but you just knew that was the case.
You knew a lot about the activities in the marketplace.
Excuse me?
You knew a lot about the activities in the marketplace among your competitors. Do you think the regulators, can you remember a time when you were hoping that they would be catching on to something that was going on and they missed it?
Well, I don't know. I think I was, I think more than that, I would say it was clear that to me, that the less regulated institutions that weren't regulated by the OCC were not subject to the same type of scrutiny and follow-up that we were. And, you know, it certainly raised a question in my mind when Countrywide became a bank holding company, I believe, and then very quickly moved to become a thrift, mm-hmm. to be regulated by the OTS. And So I thought that was an interesting switch, but, you know, I'll let you guys worry about that. But I would say, you know, from my standpoint, that the OCC has been a strong regulator and has been involved, is involved heavily at the organization. But I think from a culture standpoint, you know, we didn't really do battles with these guys because I think we lined up pretty well with where they would like to see us go. But that doesn't mean they weren't going to nudge you or find issues or take exception to things.
Did you have occasion to talk, converse, raise concerns with any regulators regarding what you were seeing?
We had conversations with regulators over a number of issues. But again, I think in hindsight, you know, they were seeing things that we weren't seeing. Or depths of things because they're in multiple institutions. And, you know, I would say we probably underappreciated the magnitude of the difference in some of the, you know, in some of the quality of what people were doing.
And I guess since you were a low-margin business because of what you were specializing in, you wouldn't have noticed that much as pricing changed in the higher-margin businesses. Or...
Well, we were competing in that space as well. I mean, we did non-prime loans. You can see it on that chart. We just were not doing nearly the volume of them that the industry in total was doing. I mean, there is a percentage of our product.
Any sense of how pricing was going for some of the non-prime stuff? And what I'm thinking of in particular, somebody told us that when the CDO came in a big way, starting about 2004, that exerted tremendous pressure on pricing, and margins narrowed because you could suddenly take a, you know, what had been your triple B piece and turn it into a triple A piece, and suddenly the pricing, the margins narrowed. Did you perceive any of that?
You know, I just can't recall that level of detail. I mean, I think that, you know, in general, the pricing for non-prime product was pretty strong over that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
For a variety of reasons. I think, but, you know, I can't tell you, frankly, in terms of what you just said, in terms of CDO... impacting that. I just don't recall that.
Okay. I have a different set of questions. Did you have?
Go ahead.
I realized I forgot to ask one thing on risk management, and that is that the theory is a firm sets its risk appetite. The board might set the risk appetite. Here's the kind of risk we want to take, and then the risk management structure translates that down into limits, into standards, whatever. Can you describe that process at Wells?
Well, I think I'm probably not in the best business to do that, in that, again, we were not big generators of balance sheet risk in the mortgage company. That being said, I think the holding, there was transparency on the balance sheet to the credit committee of the board of directors. Mm-hmm. And I don't, you know, you could talk to others. I don't think they would sit back and say, okay, we want exactly this much of this and this much of this, as much as you would say, here's the series of portfolios that we have, and here's our concentration, these type of, residential real estate, commercial real estate, credit card, unsecured consumer loans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Commercial. Here's our concentrations by geography. You know, so you could kind of get into that, and we could have a discussion in terms of, do we like this mix or not? And so it's kind of, I would say it's more a combination of bottom up and top down, where, you know, you're managing these risks in your business individually. You've got a holding company kind of looking over the top of that, trying to say, do we like this portfolio of risks and how we're pricing for these risks if we're portfolioing the loans? And then you've got transparency of the holding company or the board of directors to, mm-hmm. that could ask any kind of questions or express an opinion and make any kind of adjustment. So I don't think it was quite the top down where you're saying this is exactly what we want to do, mm-hmm. as much as we're in all these businesses, so we've got a lot of diversification anyway, but it's really keeping track of what is our relative growth rates and how are these portfolios evolving. And then, you know, in our case, we'd have the easy opportunity to sell or keep.
Mm-hmm.
But overwhelmingly, we just sold.
And one last kind of risk is operational risk. Did you, both at the mortgage company level and the group level, to what extent did you have a pretty good sense of the risks you were running from the information systems you had?
I think a good sense of operational risk. We've tried to take internal controls and process very seriously. I mean, you saw the chart in terms of market share growth. We've grown over a long period of time and over a lot of cycles, and so we've added controls throughout that period of time as we've, you know, we just think that control is the ticket to play. You know, in Wells Fargo, if you were to go back and say, what's the mantra, it's control, profitability, growth. Mm-hmm. You don't get to grow the business. That's going to last. You got to have it under control. And you have to have a business model that shows you can make money, then you can grow the business. And so it's always been in that order. And so, you know, I think we've always felt good about our internal controls. Again, we're not perfect, but we've had, I think, solid controls and solid, you know, independent audit involvement on over the top of that.
And so when Bear hit in early 07, when we went through the period of 08, August, September of 08, did your systems give you the information you needed to navigate?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest challenge over that period of time, I would say, would be in the capital markets side in terms of the hedging of our pipeline and warehouse and valuation and all that. And the answer to that is yes. I mean, we do. We mark that every day.
So you had a pretty good picture of your exposures to the market. And you, in other words, the fact of warehouse lines, whatever, was not a surprise to you.
Yeah, well, we didn't have warehouse lines. So.
Oh, okay.
Good. When I say warehouse, that would be our closed. I apologize. That would be our closed loans. I mean, our warehouse right. line, in effect, is with the holding company, is with the bank, mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. part of the bank. So. So we, you know, we're marking all our loans every day,
mm-hmm.
and we're marking them to market, and we're reporting them to the marketplace at market, you know, each quarter. But
so
we mark every day.
As all right, if you're marking every day, and start with late 06, was there any point where your P&L started to look different from what you expected in terms of the model forecasting or anything else?
Well, sure. We had some challenges in some of the areas where there's not an active forward sale market. So that you're hedging, say, non-conforming or non-Fannie Freddie type product with either Fannie or Freddie securities or treasuries or some swaps or some other instrument that is traditionally correlated, and all of a sudden the price moves on the mm-hmm. loan more because of a concern about credit or liquidity than it does on the hedge. And so we experienced some impacts of that. But we've always, for many, many years, have tried to model that risk out and make sure that we've, you know, not taking a bet the bank any type of risk on that portfolio or that subset of our pipeline and warehouse.
What does that mean in practical terms?
Well, I'm saying that if as a you can see on that chart, as percentage of our pipeline or warehouse or production, we're taking a look at how big is this segment and mm-hmm. what's our comfort level with our ability that if we had to retain all of it, that we could retain all of it, or that if there's some hedging dislocation, that we have a price difference that we can absorb that. And as a percent, as in terms of the overall Wells Fargo, that's not been, that's, you know, significant. It's certainly it was, I don't want to underplay the, you know, that there was dollars of impact there, but it was certainly very, very manageable.
We talked to a couple of survivors who did all right in the crisis, who talked about de-risking from 06 forward. Did you guys do any of that in terms of, I should also add, we talked to some that didn't survive that talked about doing de-risking, but they didn't quite understand the risks. Did you have any sort of where you started to change your parameters and say, gee, we are going to adjust, something strange is going on in this market?
I'd have to go back. I mean, we, again, depends on the, you know, we were, as I mentioned earlier, we were tightening down our underwriting in a number of different markets. And we, to this day, we model out today, I think, something like 380 different MSAs. And we categorize them in different buckets based on how we think the economy's moving, how we think housing values are moving, et cetera. So how tight our underwriting is will be different by categories of statistical area. It's a more sophisticated approach than we took back then, but we had an approach on our biggest MSAs at the time that I talked about. So that was kind of one element of de-risking. You know, we started to exit non-prime in our third-party channels, and then, you know, in, I can't remember whether that was the dates, and then, you know, we exited that before we exited retail. But, you know, we weren't doing that early in, like, 2006 or that. I mean, we were in these markets to serve the customers, but when it appeared to be uneconomic or too much risk, we exited starting with the wholesale market in non-prime, and then we exited the retail market.
And why was that?
The liquidity was drying up on the back end, and we were not going to portfolio this product, so we just got out of the channel.
No, when?
Oh, I can't recall. I think it was either 2007 or 8. I can't recall.
But it sounds as if it was incremental, that you guys were marking every day. You guys had at least models of the big MSAs, and you were taking incremental steps until you would take a major step like deciding to be out of the wholesale channel.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was not as precise as, you know, in each, I don't want to confuse some of the different channels. I mean, but there was, you know, we're running a business on a daily basis here to really, you know, we're getting feedback from the capital markets, and if there is a liquidity change in terms of our ability to sell a product, we're going to make it, you know, we're seeing that, we're reflecting that, and then we're making the change, you know, whatever decisions we need to make on the front end to correspond to that.
Any input at that point from your credit officer? I mean, are you guys having conversations, or was it largely, you've been in this business since 1979, we trust you, take care of us?
Well, again, much of what we're doing, again, was Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie stuff, where the liquidity
was still there.
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of anything that we're doing on our portfolios, we were always having those kind of conversations. Mm-hmm. So do we, and, you know, dialing back, tightening up underwriting. And that, you know, was a process that, you know, they were heavily involved in on anything that had to do with our portfolios. And I would say that was starting in, well, I don't know when, I wouldn't say start, because they've always been involved in that.
When did you think they were in trouble?
Who was it?
Fannie, Freddie.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you're asking me to recollect a lot of...
Well, so 2008 was a pretty memorable year for a lot of people.
Well, I can't even recall. Was that the year that they went into receivership, right? So, I mean, in trouble? I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I appreciated the magnitude of the non-prime book of business that, in particular, Fannie Mae had. I knew Freddie Mac had a decent-sized book, but I wasn't aware that Fannie Mae had as big a book as they had.
Were you surprised when they went into conservatorship? That would have been September of 08.
Well, you know, we were pretty busy at that point in time. So, you know, there was a lot of things going on at that point in time. Was I surprised? I don't recall what I was thinking at the time. I was probably surprised that they went when they did. But, you know.
One of my questions was to ask you about the period when the world stopped, September 2008. Do you have any interesting stories about that you could share about what it was like for you? Where were you? What it was like?
Well, I know I just announced my retirement about a month before that.
Good timing.
So, just came back from the Olympics. Just watched Shawn Johnson. I don't know if you follow Olympic gymnastics, but our daughter started in gymnastics at the same with Shawn. When our daughter was 5 and Shawn was 3. So we've known Shawn since she was a little girl, and they've been in the same gym for all those years, and then our daughter retired at the ripe age of 7th grade, but Shawn was like 5th grade. You could tell she was going to probably be an Olympian, so we were over at the Olympics following Shawn. So that was in August of 08, came back, and then you started having dominoes fall. So what was it like? Well, you'd wake up probably like you did every morning and read the newspaper and turn on TV to see what was going on. There were conversations with various institutions. There was a lot going on in terms of, you know, involvement. In terms of from our side, we were just trying to really manage our business as well as we could.
What did it mean in practical terms, in terms of the impact on your business, and after you got back from the Olympics?
Well, again, I think, you know, it wasn't that long. I mean, the Wachovia deal was in very early October, as I recall. Mm-hmm. There were other institutions that were being challenged prior to that, that we were at different levels of understanding. I'm not going to get into all the, you know, what we were involved in or not involved in, but taking a look at it in various levels. So our teams were busy.
So for you, it would have been mortgage institutions or the mortgage piece of an institution that you'd be looking at.
Right. I mean, our core business, again, you know, we were making decisions in terms of the channels we were going to be in, the products that we were going to be offering, how we're pricing those products, et cetera, which we do every day. And then there was the, in terms of things like, you know, ultimately the Wachovia deal that happened, not in September, but October, the credit team at the mortgage company and my credit officer were heavily involved in the modeling of the mortgage portfolio of Wachovia. So it was a busy time.
I need to ask you a technical question. To what extent was it your people's perception or your perception that the problems in Wachovia stemmed from Golden West as it was acquired at that point, or stemmed from decisions made after that acquisition by Wachovia?
I think it's probably both.
So Golden West had held itself out as having this great business model, and we're only making pay option arms to the people that could afford it, right? Low LTVs, etc. And the answer is maybe, but not completely. Is that a...
Well, I think that Golden West ran a very good business for many, many years, and had, you could look it up, I can't recall exactly, but very low, if not zero, and effectively zero credit losses for many, many, many years, mm-hmm. up until the acquisition, past the acquisition by Wachovia. So, by any kind of objective view of looking at how did that product perform up to that point in time, you would say this product was great.
That was during a housing bubble, which is...
Well, but I'm saying, I'm talking, I think it was 20 to 30 years.
Right.
So California had certainly gone up, but it had also come down, and I think my sense is that the Golden West believed that they had understood the market and had learned from those prior episodes in California and made appropriate adjustments to their product. Appreciate they kept almost all their loans. And the mm-hmm. loans that they did sell, they really kept recourse on. So unlike many of the competitors, Golden West had the portfolio of option arms. Mm-hmm. So they had no economic incentive, that I can think of anyway, to do poor credit.
Mm-hmm.
They had their own appraisal staff, which was unique, and they would tell you that they thought that in some of those markets there was maybe as much as a 10% difference in LTV between what they were seeing and what the competitors were valuing properties at. They had higher start rates on their product. They had different periods of time for recasting the loans and at different LTVs that were less risk mm-hmm. than what a lot of the other option arm portfolios had. So it was a well-designed product for the time, and I think they'd learned a lot. I think one of the challenges had been that they traditionally had stayed away from jumbos in California because historically those were the properties that went down first when real estate values. And so that tended to push them into some of these faster-growing markets in the Central Valley, the Inland Empire, where ultimately we know that those areas did not do better than some of the coastal areas, in fact, probably did worse. But, you know, I don't know that someone could have foreseen that at the time. I think that was a reaction to the prior, you know, X times that real estate had gone up and down in California, generally going up, but also coming down, L.A. and some of these other areas. So they made good adjustments to that product. So I think they knew what they were doing. I think this probably surprised, you know, it was not designed for this type of situation. And I think Wachovia took that and spread it out to other geographies and made some other changes. But so I'd say there was probably a combination.
Also, there were personnel changes. A lot of the Golden West people left, apparently, at the point of acquisition. Was that a factor? I mean, when I listen to you, when I listen to other people I've talked to, experience counts for an awful lot.
Well, I don't want to get into all that, honestly, because, I mean, we weren't there to kind of figure out how they got where they were.
That's our job.
As much as we were figuring out what it was worth and how we were going to manage it mm-hmm. because we weren't going to do the product. The product had already been shut down. Mm-hmm. So Wachovia was not doing it anymore.
Right.
And we sure didn't have any intention to start it back up.
Mm-hmm.
So our focus was entirely on what do we have, how do we value it, what's their approach to trying to keep customers in homes that can afford to be in their home and collect the other product out and or, you know, get the value out of that portfolio and value it. So that was really our focus,
mm-hmm.
Not so much. So, you know, we've learned a lot. I mean, we never did option arms, and that was purposeful on our part. We had a number of people in the company that had worked for institutions that did option arms, including Golden West. So not a lot, a number of key people that at least had, you know, could help us understand the product because it's a unique product. But how they got from A to B and all that really wasn't where we were focused.
I have just a couple questions. What did you learn about market panic? You've been in this business a long time. Tell me what you learned about the nature of panic.
Squeeze that.
Right. Nature of market panic. I think it's unpredictable. I think. In today's 24/7 environment, combined with the plethora of capital markets vehicles for people to go short, to do other types of transactions, and in an internet world where you can spread rumors quickly, whether they're true or false, you can get a toxic brew combined with, you know, just this rapid dissemination of information, whether it's true or false. So it's just, I think it really reinforces how we do business, why we do business, the importance of reputation risk, the importance of managing business well, and making sure that the risks that you don't think about every day, somebody's thinking about every day.
Like liquidity risk. And you thought about that too, right?
That's one of the reasons we moved the mortgage company into the holding company. Or into the bank,
right,
excuse me,
to get
into the bank many years before, is because we just did not want to, you know, we wanted to, for both a customer reason and a liquidity reason.
What did it feel like to watch it happening?
It was, sad. You know, it was surprising. Some of it was not surprising, but to see the velocity and magnitude of what was going on happen was very surprising to me and sad.
Scary?
Not scary. I mean, at some level, you know, you don't know where the bottom is.
Yeah, right.
I wanted to ask about the mess we're in now, the foreclosure paperwork mess. Do you have any insight into where that's going?
Well, I think in terms of what, where it's going... I mean, there's so many, you know, this is a small maybe version of what happened in the crisis in terms of media out there. So maybe I can ask you to be more specific in terms of what's going.
From where you just suggested, there's a lot of lines of questioning. So is it something that it can be quickly remedied and disposed of to the satisfaction of all the parties? Do you think it's something that's going to run out and create another crisis? Or is this a legal imbroglio that is going to take years to settle? I'm just asking your personal assessment.
Yeah, I can't speak for other institutions, so I can't tell you what they did or did not do. My sense is the robo-signing issue is not causing people that otherwise... should not have been foreclosed on to be foreclosed on.
Okay.
That I think. So it's tends to be. I have to be careful how I say this.
That's your personal view.
It's my personal view.
Yeah. It's a general.
We're happy to accept it as that.
Yeah. So I mean, we have said that we that we don't believe that we've foreclosed on people inappropriately. And if we make a mistake, we'll fix it. But we don't think we've had that issue. So, you know, I think the issue of does a person that's signing an affidavit, what's the relative importance of that in the overall scheme of a foreclosure? I don't want to diminish it because you've got certain, you know, legal requirements here, but I don't think it's causing inappropriate foreclosures based on what I've read that our competitors are saying and what I see. So I'm hopeful that this will remedy itself quickly. In terms of some of the other issues that have been, you know, people are tending to confuse and merge and morph various issues. Terms of what does this mean you know, more broadly in terms of repurchase risk and those types of things. Again, I can't comment in terms of our competition, what may be the case. We feel comfortable with our repurchase risk and don't think this should have any kind of material impact on that at all. See, those is not linked.
And the other thing I want to just make sure I understand, and Tom probably asked you this in another way, and maybe I just missed the answer, is can you just make sure I understand, what did you see in terms of the Wall Street securitization risk, what was going on with the CDOs? And I'm trying to get a sense of whether you understood what was packaged in them, what the quality was, how vulnerable were the investors?
I'd say no. In that, you know, we were not really a company that formed CDOs, underwrote CDOs, or really invested in them, or really had them off balance sheet, or the other various CLOs, et cetera. The only involvement that I would have had in that at all was a corporate trust business that reported to me was acting as a corporate trustee on some CDOs. But that's, you know, you're just acting as the corporate trustee on those deals where you're going to be looking at information, discerning information for the ultimate investor, but you're not underwriting, packaging, originating, any of that. So we were really, I'd say as an institution, pretty removed from that. And again, it comes back to, and I'm speaking for Wells Fargo now, Wachovia, I think, had some amount of that. I can't even tell you how much, but Wells Fargo, we were pretty well isolated from that because we were really not an investment banking firm of any, certainly doing those type of structures. So that was very much off the radar screen for what we were doing. I mean, what we were originating and selling, again, we're going into pretty vanilla structures. If someone then took our collateral and all of those structures and re-securitized those or did something else, that's kind of somebody else's business, not ours.
So you got an education in this, just like
yeah.
A lot of folks said after the fact. Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask you is we oftentimes have started off interviews by asking people what they think the cause of the crisis is, just to get them talking. But you talked about the regulators, and we asked a couple questions about that. To what extent do you think, just in this one particular question, the regulation was causal to the crisis?
Oh, I don't know. The crisis, as you guys, I'm sure, a lot closer to it than I am, and it's a very complex issue. I think there's a lot of factors involved. So to pick any one would be very difficult. I think you had a lot of factors coming together.
We have a menu.
Yeah.
I'm just asking you about one.
I know.
I'm not saying the whole cause is this one.
I think that lack of regulation, or lack of, I shouldn't say regulation, lack of effective supervision over certain sectors, or inconsistent supervision over sectors. In particular, I'm going to say the shadow banking system, which you could argue is regulated by a variety of regulators and or unregulated, or effectively unregulated, contributed to this. I mean, there are big segments of the mortgage industry that the banking, what I would say the banking sector, I'm not talking about Wall Street, I'm talking about OCC-regulated institutions, didn't really participate that much in. And there's a big flow of product away. So I think, you know, I don't know how many states really regulated their mortgage brokers. I don't know, you know, we can get into downstream from the mortgage brokers, but not a lot of that stuff didn't flow through banks. Some of it certainly did, but not everything. And a lot of the non-prime, Alt-A stuff didn't, at least through us. So, you know, I think there was inconsistent regulation there. That would be my opinion.
And part of the story that needs to be explained.
Well, yeah, whether, you know, maybe through the new Dodd-Frank bill and some of that, whether we're going to get a CFPB that really tries to cast it, whether or not they have the capability and funding and personnel to really regulate everyone they're supposed to regulate and really supervise, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. But, I mean, I think there was certainly, as I look at how we were regulated, I do not believe that same standard was consistent across the, what I'm going to say, the shadow banking system. And I've been told that in total, banks did only about 40% of the lending in this country. Mm-hmm. And so that means someone else did 60. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot if you don't have strong regulation, right? Mm-hmm. Or strong regulators.
This has been great. What did we leave out?
Oh, geez.
Nothing.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Thank you very much.